Hello, listeners. We are back with a special bonus episode of Oh My Word, and we have today a fabulous, fabulous, fabulous guest, and she is an author and an editor. She does many, many things. She'll tell you about some things that she does, and we're very lucky to have her on. And I'm telling you, till I was able to track down her peoples, to pin her down, to get an appointment with her, we're very lucky right now. So this is Jamie, everyone. Jamie, say hi to everyone, please.
Hi, everyone, please.
And I don't know how to pronounce your last name, actually.
It's Kifel Alshay. So Jamie Kifel Alshay. It's long. It's kind of a mouthful.
Yeah. So just everyone, just you know, so when you're going to go to look her up to find her afterwards, you just have to be able to type it in. You don't have to be able to pronounce it, so it's okay.
That's okay. So it's K-I, F as in Frank, E-L, and then there's a hyphen, and A-L-C-H-E-H. So it sounds like O'Shea, but it's written like Al-Sheikh.
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay. So that's what I was trying to, okay. Okay, good. Okay, very good. So thank you. So Jamie is, her main thing is that she writes kids' books, and she's written picture books and board books. I know she writes for National Geographic's also, National Geographic's Kids. So
yes.
Why don't you tell us, please, let's start with how did you get into writing? How did you get to where you are now?
I have been writing since always. I was literally 5 years old when I said I want to grow up to be an author. And a lot of things happened in the middle, but it actually turned out that I did become an author. I had been trying to sell grown-up books, and I'm still trying to do that. But I, in the meantime, had my daughter, who's now 6 years old, and my husband suggested, why don't I write for kids? And I said, are you kidding? That's even harder than trying to break in for adults. But he kept working on me, and I kept trying, and sure enough, it turned out it was easier for me to sell children's books than it was for me to sell grown-up books. So it's been going so well that I haven't gotten back to my grown-up writing in the meantime. And I now have, I think, 8 or 9 titles, either out or coming out.
Oh, wow. So that is kind of ironic that, because a lot of people also see like adult books as being, oh, that's real writing, and kids' books is not necessarily real writing. But then it is harder in many ways to break into the kids' books. So is there any formula for that, or you just got lucky, or you have to find your niche, or like, how does that happen?
It's all of the above. One piece is that writing children's book texts, particularly picture books and board books, which are those heavy stock, smaller format books that you see in stores that kids can bite and they don't break.
Right.
These books have very spare text, but they're a little bit like writing a great joke. It's a little bit of writing, but it's very hard to do right. And that is what's so difficult, I would say, about breaking in. And in terms of luck, part of the luck for me has been that I was born to an early childhood educator who was first a preschool teacher and then a preschool director. That's my mom, Beth Cassell. And she helped teach me quite a bit about the art of teaching and communicating with young children. So that's very much in my blood. How do you get a message across to a very young child? Or to a child of any age, how do you understand what they understand? And that's a big piece of the work. And the secondary part was, again, luck.
Right.
I'm going to say there must be talent there, and that was also luck because I got that from my genes. The other part is I got lucky in that I was taking my daughter to a Mommy and Me group, and I was so desperate to find a way to break in to the publishing side of things. I had been writing and writing, but I wasn't getting anything bought. And I had been taking her to a Chabad group. It's the Jewish group that it's part of the Orthodox movement, and they're really open to everyone, which is very nice. And they had a very nice Mommy and Me group that I was bringing my daughter to. And I asked, kind of out of the blue, do they know anyone who's in publishing? And the head of the group, Hani Lazaroff, said to me, yes, you should talk to Mark Loomer. He's an amazing children's book illustrator. And I thought, well, that's sort of like introducing two authors
right.
to each other. How are they going to help each other?
Right.
But actually, when I got him on the phone, he said, you know, I hear from people literally every day, but I had sent him a sample of my work. He said, you actually have something that I feel just needs that tiny little push. You
right.
just need the connection, and you could sell something, and he said, why don't you look at my website and see if you see anything in my illustrations that sparks your interest, because I have some orphaned illustrations up there that never went anywhere, and maybe we could do a book based on something you see, see if you come up with an idea. So I did that, and I found these really interesting, they looked like Indonesian paper cutouts, animals on his site, and he said, yeah, you have an idea? I said, yeah, it makes me think about Noah's Ark. And we came up with the idea for a book, which turned out to be Can You Hear a Cuckoo? And it's about animals marching in pairs to a surprise destination, which turns out in the end to be Noah's Ark. And he and I batted that one back and forth over the phone, and he did sketches, and we came up with ideas, and I wrote the text. And we sent it to Joni Sussman at Carben, and we sold that book in a week.
Oh, wow.
Which is unusual on so many fronts.
Yeah.
Because usually you don't get a response in a week. Usually you don't sell something in a week. And usually you don't pitch text with an illustrator. It's typically done separately because the publisher likes to decide who the illustrator will be.
Right.
But
right.
In this case, she said he's experienced and he has just the right style, and yes, we'll do it. So that was how the first one happened, and that was where our luck played in.
That's amazing. And so that seems also, since then, you've basically stuck with Carben for most of your books since then. I don't know, is that easier?
I have.
Right.
I have, with the exception of, within the last year, I was contacted by National Geographic, and their books division brought me on board to do some books for middle grade kids, and those are nonfiction, both about future technology. So I have a couple of books about future tech coming out soon with National Geographic books.
Oh, wow. Right, I could see that. It's already up on your, I'm actually on your Amazon page. You know, I see that. That's exciting. So National Geographic's only got to you after you'd already started publishing these kids' books?
Yes and no. The no being that I had worked for National Geographic magazine division since I was 20. That was 1999, I started with them.
Wow.
And, well, 2022. And I first worked for their magazines, then I was picked up by their digital, so I did some of their online series of articles, and then the books division. So they're all kind of interwoven to some degree, but breaking into one division after another is obviously gradual, or
right.
It has been for me.
Right. Just because we're on this now, what's a big difference you see between writing nonfiction versus writing just like a fun kids book? Do you see a big difference between fiction, nonfiction, or a fact base for middle grade versus kids? Does that allow you to write more, or what's the big difference that you're seeing between the two things?
The biggest difference is research. I do a lot of research and interviews for the nonfiction, but the similarities, I'd say, are greater than the differences. In that it's always about communicating in a personable, easy to understand way, taking concepts that are complex and making them easy to understand. And I think the greatest beauty of it in writing for any age, even including adults, is you can take a very complex topic and make it accessible. Versus trying to look for a topic that's simple and saying, well, this audience will need a simpler way in. Even the youngest children can understand very complex topics if they're explained in a simple way. So I think that's the most fun also of this type of writing. And I guess even if you think of something like the story of Noah's Ark, it's not so simple, but it's
right.
A matter of breaking it down. And when I write anything, I start by writing the as much as I want to write about it, as freely as I'd like, in whatever poetic language I want.
Right.
And then I go into the work and I start to pare it down and essentially deconstruct it until it becomes as fair as it can be. And the board books are the most deconstructed form.
Right.
That I do.
Right.
So you break it down until you have the fewest words and the most powerful words. It's really very much like writing poetry, evocative of sound, movement, texture, anything you can do, and before it falls apart into meaningless words.
Right. Well, also when you're writing a board book, how careful do you have to be with the level of vocabulary that you're using? Because you're also going to use real words for kids, mm-hmm. but how high can you really go if it's a parent reading it? So it's not like the kid has to be able to sound out the word, but you don't want to take a word that, you know, you're not going to use masticate or whatever for chewing, but how much space do you really have there for choosing words?
I would say there is room in any level book for a difficult word, as long as the majority of the words are accessible. And in terms of how do you know if you've gone above the level, there is an aspect of getting a feel for it, and that really comes from reading a lot from that age group. I read a ton of picture books and board books, and that gives you a sense of what is right for a kid. But even more than that, spending time with kids tells you, because I read books all the time with my daughter where I say, I don't know why the editor let this through, because it's not understandable for a child at this age, or the concept is really great, but the concept is older and the presentation is younger. You really can only get that by talking to children and spending time with children. Even watching children's television, there's nothing better than Sesame Street and Mr. Rogers. Today, yeah. It's still true. Right. And you can really get a good feel for what kids do and don't understand at a given age.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Because I think everyone just thinks, oh, kids just means write simply, but it doesn't mean that, right? It's not just about...
That's right.
Well,
that's right. It doesn't mean write simply. It means write accessibly. And I also tell people, this applies a little bit more to middle grade, I'd say, and teens even, but if you read a few different publications, Popular Mechanics, Popular Psychology, Mental Floss online, I'm thinking of these outlets do a really, really good job of writing in a conversational tone. And if you read them, and practically everything National Geographic does, for adults too, does it in a conversational tone, you'll find that they don't use big words unless they need them, which, of course, we were all taught in school. Don't use a big word unless you actually need it. And it seems to make the precision better, and it makes the tone friendly, and it speaks to the reader in a way that's both respectful and makes the reader feel like they can get a handle on what's being said.
Right.
Rather than being... exclusive or arch. And I think that browsing any of those will give you a little bit more of a feel for what is that friendly tone.
Right, because I think also people think, oh, if something's written conversationally, either they think that that's easy to write, or they don't think, well, that must not be real literature. And that's not necessarily true, because easy to write just means my reader can read it without having to stop every 5 minutes to try to figure out what I'm saying with these words that I found out of who knows where, you know, that just keeps the flow going better for them. I get like, well, also now that you've written middle grade versus the board books and the picture books, can you say I go through more drafts of middle grade or picture books or board books, or is each book just its own kind of journey?
How many drafts did you ask?
Yeah. Could you say, oh, board book, I only go through 5 drafts, but for middle grade, I go through 15 drafts, or that's not necessarily accurate?
Not necessarily. I would say everything I do gets about 15 drafts easily. And I remember when I started, I couldn't imagine why that would be true.
Right.
How could you go through so many drafts with so few words?
Right.
But you find yourself reinventing the story from different points of view, adding plot points, subtracting plot points, realizing a character is an extra, realizing that the style is too straightforward, could be more original, could be more interesting. What about from the fish's point of view? You know?
Right.
There are so many ways to approach it. And then I also do character studies, just like I was taught back in fourth grade, write all about each character and give them a life outside of the book, because if you do that, even if those aspects don't appear in the book itself, the reader has the sense that the characters have a life beyond the book and that it starts in the middle of the action, and that's always good. And at the same time, I also do books that are conceptual. Conceptual books are things like the Can You Hear a Cuckoo? These are not characters that need character sketches outside the book, because we're talking about doves or monkeys, we know what they are.
Right.
It isn't a big plot, although I use this opportunity to add, each book, even the simplest board books that aren't stories per se, and that's what we call a concept book, maybe it teaches pairs or it teaches an emotion or something like that, every one of those has a plot arc, some very gentle plot arc. There's a beginning, there's a middle, and there's a clear end. And especially in writing for very young children, you'll find that most of the stories end on a quiet note, because a lot of parents read these books to their kids at night before bed.
Hmm.
So you want to be careful not to end your book on a big jumping up, jumping out kind of energized note if it's for very young children, because typically we do want to bring them up and then settle them back down. So the words are doing that as well.
Oh, wow.
But again, there is a plot arc of some sort. Like in Can You Hear a Cuckoo, we don't know where the animals are going, and then in the end, we find out they're arriving at Noah's Ark, and there's a little couplet at the end that says the reason that they are doing this is because they know that friends in stormy weather, friends like these should stay together. So there's a little ending, not a moral per se, that's not too popular these days in writing, but just a reason for the story. That would be a more accurate way to say it.
Yeah, that actually is a good way to say it, because a lot of people, if they might have a great story, but if as a reader you don't feel like it's going somewhere, you just zone out. It's just, no matter how good the writing is, you're like, why am I even, like, what am I getting out of this? I want to get something out of it, whether or not it's a moral, but I want to have a takeaway. So I guess even a reason for the story is its own takeaway. And when you are thinking of, well, I guess, I don't know if you can answer this question as a broad answer, but your ideas for board books, is that something that's, oh, we're missing this, so I want to write this? Or do ideas pop in your head the same way any other story would pop into your head? Like, oh, that would be a cool thing to write about.
Both are true. Sometimes I look at the market and I try to tell what's missing. For instance, I haven't successfully sold yet, but I have a fantastic board book for Yom Kippur, which I think would be great because kids really need to understand what the heck this is.
Yeah, it's not an upbeat topic, yeah.
Right? And in a way that's not depressing. And I have a really great one for that. So I'm trying to find a home for it. That one more came to me versus sometimes I'm also looking at, you'll see that a lot of publishers will actually post on their sites, we're looking for XYZ type of book. And also look at manuscriptwishlist.com. That's a place where editors and, I don't remember if agents too, I think.
Yeah, they do.
They do. Yeah. They post what they're looking for.
Yeah.
And that's a really good place to check. And Twitter too. People will post, I'm looking for this right now. Unfortunately, what they're often posting is, I'm really looking for a story about a llama with wings that lives in Ireland.
Right,
The chances that you have it already might not be high, but maybe you do. So it is worth browsing.
Have you mainly been speaking directly with editors? Or do you go through somewhere else to... Well, I guess with Carbon, you speak directly to the editor.
Well, I have an agent, and when I'm trying to place a book, the agent goes to editors that I can't get to because I don't have a relationship with them already, or they don't take unsolicited manuscripts. But the editors with whom I already work, I do speak to directly. So Joni Sussman at Carben, I go to her directly.
Right.
And at National Geographic, I can go to them directly, which is really nice.
Right. And then you got your agent... was that something that was a slush pile, or you met her somewhere, or was it a referral?
It was a referral, and yes, I'm with Painted Words, which is in New York, and Claire Easton is my agent there, and that was actually through somebody who already worked with them who suggested that I reach out, and I did quite a lot of back and forth with them before I sent them something that they thought was a fit for them.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's
that was a long process, like a several year long process.
Oh wow! Well, that I don't know if that's usual or not, but it seems, you know, if an agent's interested, then they're on board, and if they're not, then they're not. So I don't know if knowing someone there, or if they just were like, we'd really like you, but you haven't yet given us the right tool yet. I don't know. Have you heard of a situation that are like that people can really go back and forth that long?
Yes, but I have heard some people talk about having novels that they were trying to place with agents, that there was quite a lot of back and forth. I'm not sure it's too unusual. No, I do think it happens.
Well,
it's hard to place with anybody.
Yeah.
Agent, publisher, it's hard.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people think it's just automatic. Like, oh, I found my agent, so now next step is bestseller.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but there is something to be said for I found the agent. Because
right.
There's also a problem when people are going after agents just to get an agent, which is very easy to find yourself doing. If you found someone who you feel is really a great fit for your work, the trick is then telling them why, so
right.
that they don't think you just picked them at random.
Oh, yeah, that's a really good point. And is your agent someone who is willing to rep all age groups that you want to write for, or she specifically is for kids' books and middle grade younger readers?
Exactly. Kids' books. Yeah, kids' books.
So that would mean that whenever you do return to your adult stuff,
mm-hmm.
you'd have to find somebody
separate
else then?
Agent. Exactly.
Well,
that's right.
Well, I think also that's something that a lot of people don't think of, because every agent,
mm-hmm.
they've got to be the pro in their market, and most agents are not going to just spread themselves across the entire market like that. So
yes, and something else I hadn't thought of when I started out is that an agency that has too many too many famous people that they rep, or too many people overall,
right.
not going to have a lot of time for you. And I have been told that, but it's really true. It's often better to see if you can find someone who's a little lower in the ranks but excited and has time and is eager to work with you, rather than trying to get that very well-known agent. And I know it's hard, because it feels like you want to get the Harvard or the Princeton
right.
to rep your work.
Right.
And you do, but ideally you get a well-known agency with a beginning agent.
Oh, that's a good point. That's actually a real good
mm-hmm.
point. Okay, I'm trying to think what else can we talk about with picture books? Actually, when you are writing, how much are you visualizing, and how much can you say about what you're visualizing versus, no, you got to step back and let the artist or the illustrator do their thing? Like, how much say do you actually have in that?
So it's a little bit like writing a script. When you're done with your script, you hand it over to the director and they realize it.
Right.
Yet it's different in that you're not expected to tell the illustrator how to do their job. If there are aspects of the story that can't be seen in the writing, that you can't write in, or that it would be overwriting to write it in, but that are important to the plot. So, for instance, Emily is peeking out of the closet. You know, that would be an illustrator note that you could include.
Right.
But Emily's skirt is pink. If it's not part of the plot, that's not up to the author to include. And that's hard for a lot of authors to get used to as an idea. But in truth, the idea is that half of the book belongs to the author and half of the book belongs to the illustrator. And that's even reflected in your contract. You'll be paid half of the fee for the book, and half of the fee will go to the illustrator. So that is why when you're writing, you're not going to write in, she put on her favorite purple earrings with the little feathers and her top hat. You might say she put on a quirky outfit.
Right.
Sounds funny, but that's left to the illustrator to interpret. Even though I am envisioning something. And hopefully my vision comes through in the writing. I have a book that came out this past year called Kol HaKavod, Way to Go. And the way that the illustrator, who I had never met or spoken to, who lives in England, drew the illustrations matched my vision so precisely, I couldn't believe it. It was like she had looked inside my brain.
Wow.
So I must have made it come through in the way that I wrote the text. Because
right.
she just got it.
Well, do you have any contact with the illustrator, or once you head in the text, they take it from
typically,
you, like, that's
no.
it?
Nope. Typically, all that happens is the publisher sends me some sketches before it's final and says, does anything jump out at you as being not correct or something that needs changing? And so, for instance, on the last book I looked at, I noticed that there were no children with disabilities in the images. So I wrote back and I said, I'd like to see some children who are differently abled in the book.
Right.
So the illustrator came back and added that, and that was great. And I said, I see it's on one page. Let's add it on more pages so that it's not just a gesture, but this child is actually one of the friends in the group. So hopefully they'll do that. But that's the kind of input that I can give. I wouldn't give input like, I don't know why you drew green clothes on them. I really would like to see them in red.
Right, right. Yeah.
Unless I already wrote in the text that green is his least favorite color. Why is he wearing green? Then it would be justified.
Yeah, that's a good point. So that also means you got really lucky with that. You really did get lucky with the first book that you were able to look at the illustrations and then work as a team, because otherwise, you really don't have, you have no say.
It's true. You have to trust that the publisher has been doing it for a long time and they know what's going to be best with your words and what's going to sell the book as well. Now, that said, there is always a point where the illustrator shows you the art, and if you hate it,
right.
And you can tell me, has this happened to you with covers as well? If you get to see it before your book comes out and you can say, look, I just hate it, they will talk to you.
Right.
See if something can change.
Right. I've actually gotten pretty lucky with my covers so far, thank God. Because
your covers are great. I've seen
them. Oh, thank you. Yeah, they are. No, they really are. There were certain things that I told them from the outset that I was like, I don't really want to see someone's face on it, because sometimes it doesn't blend right. You know, sometimes when you're doing stuff like that. They did it such a good, and then even I was like, oh, maybe this for a cover. And they came back to me like, no, these are going to be your covers. And I was like, yes, please make all of them. Do all these like that. It's so great when it surpasses your expectations or it's something that you never thought of.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I guess also does that affect, because if you're going to go to an agency and they're going to try to hook you up, they're going to try to get one of their illustrators on board with your text, I'm assuming. So is that also is that really important then to look at who their illustrators are to say, oh no, I might get stuck with that, or like don't even think about that. Do your text and just trust the process.
Whether you tell them you don't want to be stuck with this particular illustrator?
No, if you see that they represent illustrators that you don't like but you're like, oh, I don't like anybody in their agency. Yeah.
So not all agencies represent both illustrators and authors, although many do.
Right.
But that shouldn't really affect who your illustrator will be, because it's the publisher, not the agency, who's going to play into that. Now, Painted Words has offered to have an illustrator from their stable do sample art and submit it with my writing if I want. Sometimes that's helpful.
Right.
Sometimes it's not. So it's a choice. It's a choice. It's not something that will happen automatically. And typically we don't submit with art.
Oh, so those samples, is because they're pitching that illustrator, or they just think it will help sell the book to the publisher?
Both. I would say both.
Okay. Yeah, that's important to know. Also because writers have to realize that at a certain point, the project's not in your hands anymore. I think a lot of people they get a little bit too attached to things that you have to trust that these are the professionals. They sometimes know what they're doing. They usually know what they're doing.
Usually know, and it is a matter of trust. So, but you do get to say something. If you absolutely despise something, you can certainly, they don't want to do something you despise.
Right. And just as a general thing, even though I know people kind of look this up, about how many words can you put in a board book, and about how many words, what's like the sweet spot for board book and what's for picture books? For how many words?
I'm not sure what to say for a board book. It might be as few as 100 or fewer.
Oh, wow.
That'd be 5 words.
Wow.
Really short.
Wow.
A picture book, it tends to clock in at about 500 words.
Right.
But I will say this. I really love rhyme. Rhyme is notoriously hard to sell.
Yeah.
I've been very fortunate.
Yeah.
When you are writing in rhyme, it is easier to write spare. you don't use as many words.
Oh.
But I just find that to be true. When I write in rhyme, it's very short.
Right.
But most editors, when they are interviewed, will tell you they are not looking at word count. They're, again, kind of doing it by feel. They're reading it, and they can feel if the story is too long or if it's too short, and you'll get a feel for the same. And that also comes from reading lots and lots of picture books. Some people will, and it's always the editors, it's always the agents for some reason who will be tied to word count and who will claim that you shouldn't read old books because the books aren't sold better. The books sold today are different from the books that were sold long ago.
Right.
It's kind of true. It's kind of true. But you know what? If you read the classics, people will buy a classic anytime. And if it's long, they're still going to love it. They
right.
know what a good book is.
Right.
So trust in the classics. Reread the classics. Don't be afraid. Ferdinand the Bull is a story that I believe could sell any day, anywhere. And that is one old book. It just, and people talk about how you can't do Dr. Seuss now because Dr. Seuss was already done. I wish people would stop talking about what you can't do.
Right.
And more about what you can do.
Right.
Because inspired writing is inspired writing. Beautiful writing is beautiful writing. The best of the Dr. Seuss books are fabulous teaching opportunities. They are just brilliant books. And they're brilliant for a reason. And the more you read them, the more you understand. So if you're drawn to something and you know that it's just incredibly beautifully written, read it and reread it until it gets into you, and you'll find yourself writing beautiful things too.
Wow. That's such a good note to end off on, actually. That's so great. Unless, is there anything else that you want to add, though? Is there any titles you'd suggest people to check out, aside from the ones you've already said? Or, like, wow, if... like, this is a great writer, or all picture book writers should see the work of this person, or anything else you want to give about tips or advice for writing for kids?
Well, the biggest tip I want to give is be patient. Be patient with yourself, be patient with the process, and please don't listen to the people who say you can't and there are rules. I'm sorry, I'm tired of it. It's just not true. There are no rules, and you can do anything that you feel you can do if you are passionate about it, because passion always comes through. And you asked me about titles. I'm just scanning my bookshelf, which is packed with great things.
Yeah.
Harry the Dirty Dog, reread that. Read Richard Scarry again.
Yeah.
Read read the Stieg books, like I've got Solomon and the Rusty Nail here. What a bizarre book. It's definitely worth reading. Madeline, all the great books. Reread the Little Bear books and Frog and Toad, and it's just no end. Anything, Ezra Jack Keats, of course, Robert McCloskey, Make Way for Ducklings. Even go back to all the nursery rhymes, because they have an eloquence that is worth taking in, and maybe you want to rewrite them in a modern way. I could just go on and on. There's so many wonderful books. If there's a book that you loved growing up, go back and reread it and find out why. Because you'll find out why.
Right.
Pull it apart. And
right.
Some people even sit down and they retype the text right out of the book just to get the feel and discover, oh, I never noticed that phrase, or I didn't realize it. And enjoy it. Because it's really a job that comes out of love and caring for children and the children inside of us.
Oh, that's fabulous. It's so great. I'm so glad we got to do this. I'm so glad we had you on. Thank you so much for making the time. Thank you.
Thank you so much.